This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The tobacco industry has been taking a lot of heat from Congress and the FDA in the past few months. Now tobacco public relations experts are getting a kick in the pants from satirist Christopher Buckley. His new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. Buckley is only afraid that his satire might be outpaced by the absurdity of current events. His novel was already completed in April when seven tobacco company executives gave sworn testimony at a congressional hearing denying that nicotine is addictive and that cigarettes have been proven to cause disease and death. Buckley is a former speechwriter for George Bush and is the author of the bestseller The White House Mess, a satire of White House memoirs. He's the son of famed conservative writer William F. Buckley. I'll let Christopher Buckley describe the premise of his new novel.
The basic premise of the book is a group of Washington spokesmen for dangerous industries. The hero of the book is a guy named Nick Naylor, who, as you might guess from his name, is the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry. His two best friends are a woman named Polly, who's the chief spokeswoman for the liquor industry, which in this case calls itself the Moderation Council, and a fellow named Bobby Jay, who is the chief spokesman for the gun industry, which in this instance calls itself SAFETY, which stands for the Society for the Advancement of Firearms and Effective Training of Youth, formerly the National Right to Bear Arms Committee. And collectively, they call themselves the Mod Squad, which stands for, not for the TV show, but for Merchants of Death. So it's about sort of yuppie, likable yuppie mass murderers, if you will.
Let's see how your character, Nick, your spokesperson for the cigarette industry, handles himself on the Larry King show. And your character has basically told Larry King that 96% of heavy smokers never get seriously ill. You want to pick it up from there?
Sure. "Where does that figure come from?" said Larry. "From the National Institutes of Health, right here in Bethesda, Maryland." Nick thought to himself, "Let NIH deny it tomorrow. Tomorrow people would be on to the next thing. Bosnia, tax increases, Sharon Stone's new movie, Patty Davis's latest novel about what a bitch her mother was." As long as he was at it, he threw in, "And from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia." "That is news," Larry shrugged. Larry was basically too polite to accuse his guests of being shameless liars. It was probably why Ross Perot liked him so much. With any luck, no one from NIH or CDC would be watching. "Of course," Nick said, "neither Secretary Furioso nor the Surgeon General, both of whom continue to refuse to debate with me on the issues, want you to know that, or their budgets will go down. Sad, but true." "Interesting," said Larry. "There are a lot of things," Nick sighed, "that the government doesn't want people to know about tobacco, such as," Nick thought to himself, what? "The indisputable scientific fact that it retards the onset of Parkinson's disease." Larry said, "So you're saying we should all wait till we're 65 and then start smoking like crazy?" "Well, Larry, we don't advocate that anyone should take up smoking. We're just here to provide the scientific facts. Like the report that just came out showing that tobacco smoke is replenishing the ozone that has been lost due to chlorofluorocarbons." "Really?" Larry said. "Well, maybe I should take it up again. Do my part for the ozone hole. I better check with my doctor first." "Doctors tend to have their own agendas," Nick said. "I'd also like to call to your attention the report last week that smokers who are clerical workers tend to get less carpal tunnel syndrome. You know, the wrist thing. Because they take more breaks. There's something else the, quote, medical science establishment, unquote, doesn't want you to know about."
Well, thanks for reading that. That's Christopher Buckley reading from his new book, Thank You for Smoking. You've said the inspiration for this book came from watching the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour and watching somebody from the Tobacco Institute defending tobacco. What interested you so much in watching somebody defending smoking? People who are paid to defend it.
Their motivation. I didn't know anyone I went to college with whose ambition was to become the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry, or for that matter, the liquor industry or the gun industry. I wondered how, you know, 30-something, 40-something, you know, attractive yuppies ended up in this, doing this for a living. So I, having decided to write the book, I called them up, and I was mildly disingenuous about what my motives were. I said that I told them I was researching a book on Neo-Puritanism, which Thank You for Smoking also is, and that I wanted to hang out with them and see what it was like to have to, you know, be in the front lines of the of all these anti-movements. And their motivation in the end turned out to be a little more prosaic than inspirational. At the end of the second meeting with this cigarette lady, I was dying to ask her, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? Of course, being a sensitive 90s male, I don't talk like that, Terry. So instead I asked her, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? And I remember very clearly she exhaled her lung full of smoke and shrugged, a very sort of sexy Lauren Bacall shrug, and said, I'm just paying the mortgage. And thus was born Nick's yuppie Nuremberg defense. I was only paying the mortgage. It was the motivation that interested me.
You know, I could say that it's easy for you to be cynical about the defense I was only paying the mortgage, since you've got a lot of dough yourself and you don't have to worry about it.
No, I'm a mortgage payer, Terry.
But it's probably a real big one.
I'm trying to pay it off. Don't like the idea of working for the First Bank of Boston for the rest of my life. That's why I write these books, Terry.
Your defense.
Yes, that's my defense. We're all one way or the other paying the mortgage.
Was it entertaining for you to try to come up with speeches for Nick to defend the tobacco industry with?
Absolutely. It was actually, though I find writing very hard, this was kind of fun to do. You know, there you are. You're the front man for an industry that kills, 435,000 human beings a year. That's just American human beings. And what do you say? You know, when you go on the Oprah show and you find yourself, you know, on with the, you know, the head of the Anti-Smoking Office of Health and Human Services and the head of Mothers Against Teenage Smoking, and then, uh-oh, what's this? A bald teenager, bald down, including no eyebrows. Turns out he has cancer from smoking. You know, what do you do? It's at that professional, at the technical level, it's a hell of a challenge.
Well, I love what you gave your character to do. I mean, Nick is very funny and can think on his feet. So in the middle of the Oprah show, and you just described all the other guests, he asks for a cigarette. And you want to explain why?
Yeah, Oprah has just given her introduction where she's talked about the 435,000 deaths per year. She's talked about RJR's Old Joe Camel promotion, which has hooked millions of American kids. You know, more kids can recognize Old Joe now than do Mickey Mouse. She's introduced all the other guests, all of whom are just, you know, fire-breathing anti-smokers. And then the last one is this poor 19-year-old teenager who's, you know, clearly dying of cancer and has had radiation treatments. And then she introduces Nick, and, you know, all the audience is glowering at him. And so what does Nick do? He pulls out a cigarette and asks and says, do you mind if I smoke? And there's this gasp in the audience, and she says, you want to smoke? And he says, well, you know, I understand it's traditional to offer the condemned man one last cigarette. And that kind of breaks the ice, and the audience actually, one person in the audience starts to laugh, and then other people in the audience starts to laugh, to the great annoyance of the anti-smokers on the panel.
You've watched all the TV shows with all the smoking industry people defending cigarettes. What's the most incredible or interesting defense that you've heard them give?
Well, the obvious defense is that it's a free country, and 45 million Americans want to smoke. It's a legal product. They ought to be allowed to smoke as long as they don't, you know, blow it into your lungs. Believe it or not, there is some good news about not smoking but nicotine, which the anti-smoking movement doesn't really like to bring up. But in fact, there is strong medical evidence to suggest, as I read in that section of the book, that nicotine retards the onset of Parkinson's. Smokers have a 50% less rate of Alzheimer's disease. They have a 50% less incidence of endometrial cancer. Believe it or not, I mean, I guess God made nicotine for a reason. And so, you know, they could sort of hit it on that angle, but that they can't, you see, because they're a little hamstrung, because you can't make health claims for these things. It would be a little bit ridiculous if they went up before the Waxman Committee and said, well, but look at the evidence about smoking and Parkinson's disease. You know, there'd be loud guffaws from the back of the room. So I guess I guess they're stuck with, it's a legal product. 45 million Americans want to smoke under the Constitution of the United States, under the tenets of Adam Smith. Someone's going to supply him with that tobacco. Why not us?
Satirist Christopher Buckley is my guest. His new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Buckley is my guest, and his new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. Did you used to smoke?
Yeah, I was a juvenile delinquent, and like most people I knew, and I started smoking when I was 13, and I smoked on and off. I started to give up, I started to give up in my late 20s, and then I finally gave up on September 14th, 1988, at 11:22 a.m., after keeping watch with at the bedside of a friend who was dying of lung cancer. His doctors told me he had 7 tumors in his lungs the size of golf balls. And without going into details, I can report that it is a pretty gruesome spectacle watching a human being die like that. And a toggle switch just sort of went off, and I've never again really had the urge, even after the second martini, which was when it used to strike.
How much had you smoked before that?
Oh, I smoked Camel Unfilters. So I never really, if I smoked 10 a day, that was a heavy day. The worst consumption was probably when I was in college, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and the 20-page paper on light imagery in Canto 12 of Spenser's The Faerie Queen is due at 8 a.m. in the morning, or you will not graduate, and that paper had to get done. And, by 8 o'clock in the morning, there was a yellow stain on the ceiling above where I had been sitting, and, you know, I'd gone through 2 packs of Camels, and, you know, there was that awful feeling that your lungs had been strip-mined. Well, I don't have that anymore.
May I point out that not a lot of juvenile delinquents wrote papers on Spenser's Faerie Queen?
Well, that was a little later on.
When was the 20s. Transformation?
From juvenile delinquent? Well, I guess technically, once I reached legal smoking age, which in Connecticut was 16. I'm not sure what it is these days. I think it may be 18.
Can we talk a little bit more about your youth?
Sure.
When you were very young, did you share your father's political views, his conservative political views?
Well, not when I was very young. As you know, the saying goes that a fellow who isn't a socialist when he's 20 has no heart, and a fellow who is a socialist at 40 has no head. I was reasonably rebellious, but I didn't have much of a chance to be rebellious. I was shipped off to a Benedictine boarding school run by monks when I was 13. So I spent the glory years of the 60s, you know, while the Summer of Love, Haight-Ashbury, Woodstock, you name it, while that was going on, I was in study hall with monks. So my rebellion took the form of shipping out in the Merchant Marine when I was 17, when I got out of boarding school.
Christopher Buckley is my guest. Your first novel, Steaming to Bambula, was based on your experiences on a freighter, And I guess it must have been after you got out of school, before college, that you signed onto a freighter as a deckhand, and that became the basis of your first novel. Why did you want to go onto a freighter?
Well, I grew up around boats, and I always thought that shipping out would be the most romantic thing you could do. I'd read Conrad and Melville, and my boarding school, this Benedictine boarding school, was on Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, and it had, though it was a very good school, it had, a boarding school is kind of like a prison if you're 13, 14, 15. And I would see all these freighters go by. And I would go down to the beach and sort of look at them and kind of wish I was, wish I could be aboard shipping out to exotic ports. And a couple of years later, I got my chance, and I signed on as a deck boy on a round-the-world Norwegian tramp freighter. And saw a bit of the world and came back with a tattoo, even.
What did the tattoo say?
Well, I had two tattoos, actually. One was on my upper arm, and it's a full-fledged tattoo with an eagle and sailing ships and flags and all that. And then I had another tattoo on my right hand, which, this being a family radio show, I probably can't say what it said, but it was if I held my hand in the saluting position, the officers receiving the salute would be more likely to be offended than pleased.
You had that tattoo removed.
I had that tattoo eventually removed when I had it for about 8 or 9 years. And one time I was working for Esquire and I was interviewing the King of Spain. And we were sitting sort of close together. And I found his eyes straying to the outer edge of my right hand. And I thought, well, here we're on the verge of a serious diplomatic problem here. So when I went back home, I went to a dermatologist, and this was in the days before laser abrasion, and he took out a shiny scalpel and cut it out, closed it up with 13 stitches.
Well, that must have hurt pretty good.
Yes, it did. Well, what goes around comes around. I'm a big believer in karma, and I guess I just, paid for my stupidity 9 years later.
So now when you salute, you have a scar.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't do as much saluting these days.
Let me just say here that I've just been informed that Steaming to Bambula is really a memoir, not a novel. So I stand corrected. I was reading this great anecdote about you in a Washington Post article about you that said, I think this was in the early 70s, you were coming home from Yale for the weekend or something, and you had dropped acid and came home to find that there was a 60 Minutes crew at home doing a profile of your father, and you ended up getting interviewed
I picked the wrong moment to duck into the house to pick up a sweater. Yes, it was. It was an interesting day.
I'd like to know what all of that looked like to you in your altered state.
Well, Mike Wallace's face looked like under two hits of California sunshine. Well, it looked a little bit like Picasso's middle period.
And what was it like to be interviewed?
Well, it was extremely uncomfortable, Terry.
What kinds of questions?
We dropped acid, and it was getting cold, so we happened to be walking by the apartment. I said to my friend, "I'm just going to duck in and get a sweater." So we went in, and I literally tripped over a coaxial cable in the foyer, and I thought, "What's this?" And I looked up, and there was Mike Wallace saying, "Oh, great. We'll put you on next." And so I ran upstairs and found my mom, and I said, I really do not want to go on. She said, no, you have to do it for your father. I said, no, really, trust me. I really don't want to go on. She said, no, you must go on. So, you're 17. Your mother tells you to do something. You still have to do something. So on I went.
And what'd you say? Did you ever see it back?
Yeah, but it was an excruciating 45-minute interview. But obviously, I mean, the show was not about me. I mean, they were looking for the 5-second bite to the question. Do people ever razz you about your dad? And I guess I managed to get through it without drooling. But it was with great relief that I got back to the street afterwards.
What was your father's reaction when he found out, perhaps well, years later, hardly, that you were high?
Well, we haven't really discussed it. I think he's a really wonderfully tolerant and understanding guy. I mean, he would not have enjoyed it at the time if I had said, "Hey, Dad, I do acid." But he was always a remarkably tolerant, I dare say, liberal dad.
Among the many things that you've written and jobs you've held as a writer, you were a speechwriter for then-Vice President Bush in the early 1980s. What kinds of occasions did you have to write speeches for?
Well, I was his only... I was Vice President Bush's chief speechwriter, or only speechwriter, from 81 to 83. And I wrote everything he said, other than the ones he winged. So there were there would be speeches, there were toasts, there were a lot of eulogies. Remember, his motto was, "You die, I fly." arrival statements, departure statements, just about everything. It was really a great experience, and to anyone who's thinking of going into the speechwriting business, I would only offer the observation that writing for a vice president is in some ways a lot more fun than writing for a president, because you see them, you actually see them, you travel with them. The Reagan speechwriters that I knew hardly ever saw him. One of them had seen him twice that year, and that was to pass him in the hallway. There are so many layers between you and your principal.
Are there certain things that you felt were cliches, but you felt you had to use them anyways, that you need an element of that in speeches?
Well, I managed to get through my year and a half without ever typing the words, "This great nation of ours." This was probably my proudest accomplishment.
Christopher Buckley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Christopher Buckley's new novel is called Thank You for Smoking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.